The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, Rupert Everett is an actor, director and author, perhaps best known to you for films like My Best Friend's Wedding, An Ideal Husband, Shrek the Third, Napoleon, The Happy Prince and so many more. Well, his latest project is a book. It's a collection of stories called The American No. And I caught up with Rupert last week and I asked him, first of all, to explain the title.
Well, The American No was a phrase coined by a producer friend of mine, and it refers to what happens in our side of show business, kind of behind the scenes, when you go to pitch ideas to, say, a Hollywood studio, and you go into an office where there's 5 or 10 people, and you tell your story, you tell the jokes, you act the characters, everyone laughs. When you leave, someone takes you out and they sling their arm around your shoulder and they say things like, you know, you're a perfect fit with us and we love you down here at Bottomy Bay Productions. And you leave the meeting literally walking on air. You think it's in the bag. And then, of course, you never hear another word. And that is called the American No.
The American No. When you think it's yes, but it's no.
It's no.
And you have bought the Cadillac in your head at
and
this point.
You've bought a new house. You've taken a second mortgage. Everything.
I was reading in one article about you that Ridley Scott gave you the American No when you sought a part in Gladiator.
Well, he didn't actually really give me the American No. I approached him because I'd been in Napoleon, and I thought maybe I'd try my luck. So I said, any chance for me to be in Gladiator 2? And he said, give me a couple of weeks or 3 weeks to work it out. And then that isn't quite the American No, because normally speaking, you do those things through agents, and then, yeah, you know, things move on very quickly. So I don't accuse him of the American No, really.
Mm. Did you have a part in mind?
Well, no, I didn't know really what was going to be...
Any old ancient Roman would do.
Any old ancient Roman, although I was a bit worried because, you know, my moobs, I don't think would have looked very nice in one of the outfits. So perhaps I was saved.
Now, how often is it that you approach them? I read also that you approached the Emily in Paris crew and said, I want to be in it. I'm right for this.
Well, you know, you have to be proactive in our business. Unless you're incredibly lucky and it's kind of green lights all the way, at a certain point you work it out that if you don't push yourself, no one else is going to do it. So I think all the way through my career I've been fairly pushy. Mm-hmm. And more than ever you need to when you get older, because remember, just as there was, you know, 20,000 of us age 20 going for, say, 3,000 roles. Now there's still 20,000 of us age 60 going for 3 roles. So we're all clawing our way to get to the parts.
What is it like to make the transition from leading man to character actor?
Well, for me, I think it's been great because as a leading man, I think I was always too wound up in trying to be a leading man. And once I gave up on my looks, or gave up worrying about them, I think I was released in a way as an actor. Mm. And the older I get, I feel the more on my game I'm becoming. So in that sense, I feel quite optimistic about the future because I really enjoy being a character actor.
Did you ever attempt to emulate the painting of Dorian Gray and do a little work on the face?
I've been dying to do a little work on the face, but the thing is, I'm terrified of the anesthetic and where it will leave my brain afterwards. I'm already incredibly forgetful, and I think it would be quite tragic to come out of a wonderful facelift to not even to be able to remember my own name.
Anyway, back to the book and the genesis of this book, because it is all about things that never happened.
Yeah, The American No is about is a series of short stories which are novellas of pitches that I've made over the years that have not made it to the silver screen. One of them actually did. My film about Oscar Wilde, I was originally going to make it with a wonderful director, and he told me to write a little book about how I saw it. So yeah. I wrote the story that we have in this book,
Sebastian
Melmoth. So the others are just other stories of ideas that I thought of for myself. So in a way, the book is quite autobiographical as well, because all the stories have central characters that I thought I was going to play myself.
I mean, in some of the stories, there's one called The Wrong Box, which reminds me of a Peter Sellers movie called the wrong box. But in this case, the box is a coffin.
The box is a coffin. And that film was a film that got made that I was writing on. It was the film I made with Madonna called The Next Best Thing. And John Schlesinger was the director. And I was the writer at a certain point. And we were looking for a new way for my character and Madonna's character to arrive late at a funeral. And I remembered this story from when I was much younger, when I'd gone to a funeral of a friend's mother and we'd been on too many drugs and we'd followed the wrong hearse.
You remark, theatre is not for those who bleed easy. And it is a difficult game. I mean, you need to be the eternal optimist. And yet many people don't have, they have a superficial confidence, but not a real confidence that they will get there.
I think confidence isn't really, what you need is just a thick skin, and you need to be able to keep going, come what may. And you need to really find a way of dissolving the bitterness of rejection, because that can become a whole life. Once you get rejected and rejected and rejected, which most of us do, it can form a carapace that really makes you unfit for living.
And the injunction from you is don't get bitter.
You can't. I mean, I am very bitter, I admit, already, but you have to find a way to dissolve the bitterness and keep going.
Now, in the story, Sebastian Melmoth, which is based, of course, on the name that Oscar Wilde took, which in turn is based on a book that he wrote, which in turn is based on an earlier book from 1820.
Mm-hmm.
That story portrays the last days of Oscar Wilde in quite an upsetting way. You know, I didn't know if this is an accurate portrayal of how he lived the last time of his life. It's awful, really, what happened to him.
Yeah, the end of his life, in the great biography by Ellman, Ellman had got ill by the time he was finishing the book. So the last chapter of the book, Wilde's Life in Paris, is the shortest. But I was always incredibly inspired by it because there's something so operatic and tragic and fantastic about Oscar Wilde's death in a way. And for me, it was always the most interesting part because there you see Oscar Wilde as the kind of Christ figure, certainly a Christ figure for the gay movement, because in a way he sacrificed himself, not so that our sins may be forgiven, but so that the road to gay liberation could begin. Because before that, homosexuality wasn't a thing that was talked about, maybe between men, certainly not with women. But with Oscar Wilde, you know, paddling around the boulevards of Paris, he was famous, and you could point at him and say, that is a homosexual man. And that was really the first time that a face had been given to the...
But in using this name, Sebastian Melmoth, did he think that people didn't know who he was?
I think he... No, I think he did know people knew who he was. But I think for reasons of, you know, being chased, he was always short of money and he was always having to leave hotels without paying the bill. So I think the name helped him a lot. And also because he was romantic and dramatic, I think he thought it was exciting to be called somebody else.
You have a great turn of phrase, and I've just selected one from that story. He rummages for change and rises with difficulty. It's not easy to squeeze blood from a broken heart.
Hmm.
Well, says it all about Oscar Wilde. And yet he indulged himself. He didn't scrimp and save to make sure he had enough money for bread and cheese the next day.
No.
If he had any money at all...
He just spent it.
Spent it on pleasure.
Mm. No, he did. He's a great inspiration. And it's very exciting, you know, arriving in Dublin and driving through Merrion Square and seeing his house. For me, it's still very, very moving. He is the Christ figure for me.
Do you have any Irish connections? Because one of the stories about the £10 pom is about an Anglo-Irishman, ex-British Army, who decides to pay the tenner and go to Australia.
I do have an Irish grandmother. Irritatingly, she was born in England because obviously when Brexit started...
She could have been very useful.
I reached for... the telephone directory to see if I could become Irish, but you can't unless the grandparent was born in Ireland. But I have an Irish grandparent and lots of Irish relatives. But this story is a story that I started thinking of when Titanic came out. And here again, I was thinking, how could I make my own Titanic? And I'd read about the £10 poms. And I'd always found that story very romantic, the idea of all these old liners that had were almost decommissioned, taking people from England to start new lives in Australia. And the boats went via Lisbon to Naples to Greece and then down to Australia. And then when Brexit happened, I decided I'd move to Ireland. And I went to stay in an apartment in a wonderful castle in County Carlow. And it was really very amazing experience. And that inspired me to think of my character as a kind of Anglo-Irish man whose family had gradually lost everything, and he decided to turn it all in and go to Australia.
And I mean, the story is about the £10 palm and all of those others who went to Australia, but you construct the backstory so meticulously. I mean, where his family originally came from, over with Cromwell or whatever, and then remarking that the chin survived all the way down to the present day.
But not the money.
But not the money. And the money is eroded bit by bit by bit with a little injection from another family for a while.
Exactly.
So that backstory.
Well, the backstory, I think that's the exciting. When you're an actor and you get a script, you always have to invent yourself a backstory so that you know what you're doing. And it's always the most fun thing. And so in this story, I suppose I was just inventing the backstory for the character, because he takes this whole history somehow with him. And then he comes back as a ghost. When he dies, I don't want to ruin the story, but he dies and comes back to Ireland as a ghost, not really knowing he's dead until he sees his old aunts throwing earth on his coffin back in County Carlow.
This is the Rathdown Abbey. And, because Rathdown is where I live, Dublin Rathdown, Dunleary Rathdown, rather, is the constituency. Moving on to another story which features the Indian Mutiny. Now, is this based on fact? It's about a young English woman who marries an English army officer. They go to India and trouble befalls.
Yes, it's based on fact. There was a general called General Wheeler, and he was the general in charge of Cawnpore, which had one of the biggest sieges in the mutiny, made by an Indian prince called Nana Sahib, who the English had just cut off from being a Maharaja. And finally, they were holed up for 3 or 4 weeks. Half of them were all killed, and they finally managed to sue to get safe passage to the Ganges. And Wheeler's, all his children died, apart from one daughter, and she disappeared on the exit. They got to the Ganges, and then the Indians routed them and killed them all. Basically.
They broke their word.
They broke their word. Yeah. And she disappeared. And in the Illustrated London News at the time, there's a drawing of her with two guns killing lots of Indian people, and that's what they kind of thought she did and disappeared. But in fact, what had happened to her transpired in much later, not as late as I put my story. My story is in 1921. In fact, it was in 1900. A vicar in Lucknow is doing a midnight mass at Christmas, and a little Indian girl says, please, please, please come afterwards, and takes him deep into the bazaar to this Muslim household and into the purdah area of this household, where all these women are veiled and sitting in rows, to a room where this old lady is dying. And she says, I'm General Wheeler's daughter and I want to confess. And it's a true story.
It's a true story.
That's a true story.
Quite a remarkable story.
It's remarkable. And I thought, God, what a great beginning to a series about the Indian Mutiny. But what I didn't realize is that it's still, and even more so now in Modi's India, it's a very raw subject and not one that I think we can deal with. And it's a horrible story, but it's extraordinary too.
And it's brilliantly told by you, I have to say, with not Wheeler, but rather Saunders in the name.
Yes, because then I married it with my own grandmother, great-grandmother, who came from a rather jolly family in Northumberland, and she was married to a man that she'd met on a summer holiday, and then, made that enormously long trip on boats, 3 months on a boat in 1900 to India to meet a man who suddenly was someone completely different, a really nasty piece of work in the Indian army. And I've always felt... He died almost a year later, so she was widowed, luckily for her. But he was one of my great-great-grandfather, and that side of my family were fairly nasty kind of empire rulers, I always thought.
Now, you talk about nothing being wasted. Those pitches that didn't get made, and you mentioned that a couple of them did actually get made, but you start doing this because if the agent is not knocking on your door and the directors are not knocking on your door, you kind of have to keep yourself busy or you'd go mad.
You've got to keep doing something. And also the thing about pitches or writing scripts is if the script isn't made into a film, it's non-existent because nobody reads scripts anymore. And I think one of the great things for me, one of the lucky things at having become a writer, is that this gave me the opportunity to at least keep these stories alive in some kind of flickering way, and it's validated me in a way. Mm. I feel great that they're still alive somehow, some of these stories.
Are you an obsessive?
No.
The reason I ask is because of the last story, "À la recherche du temps perdu," Marcel Proust, and you decided that this was going to be a movie.
I didn't decide it, actually. I was approached by a couple of producers who said they wanted to make a series out of Proust, and I was incredibly flattered because, obviously, if someone comes to you to adapt the workings of the great Marcel Proust, you must be somebody. And so I agreed to do it, and I made a great mistake. If anyone from show business is listening in, don't ever do anything without a contract. I've always thought that's a really petty way of dealing with things. But I said, listen, I don't know if I can do this because it is...
Seven volumes.
But listen, let me have a try. And if I can, then we'll do a deal later. So I went home and read for a few months again. I knew it quite well, the books. And then I started writing the first episode. And I did it, and it went quite well. So I rang up the producers. I said, listen, great news. I've written the script. And there was a silence on the other end of the phone, and the guy said, ah, this is great, Rupert. I'm very much looking forward to hearing your ideas. And I said, no, this isn't ideas. I've written the script. It's great. And he said, well, I'm sorry, but I don't think this is the right time now. And I went, wah, 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 wah. That was it. It was the end. But
and that was a definite no, not even an American
that's
no.
That's not an American no. That was a in the flesh no.
Now, how many, if you'll pardon the phrase, balls in the air do you have at any given time?
Well, very few balls in the air these days. But I'm writing another book. I've got a few jobs. Emily in Paris, you mentioned. Yeah. I'm doing the next season of that, which I'm really thrilled about. I like to try and find work that I could really inform on well. When I was watching Emily in Paris, you know, which is about fashion in Paris, yeah, and has got lots of kind of queeny international people, I thought, these are the kinds of roles that I could play. And then when I saw there was this Italian one, I thought, I can speak Italian. I must try and use these meager talents that I have. So I feel that it's the kind of thing I can do well. And so I'm thrilled to be doing that. I'm doing a couple of movies. It's been a difficult year last year in show business after we had the actors' strike.
The writers' strike and the actors' strike.
And the actors' and now, the writers' strike.
What about Grey? I've watched season one. Is there season two?
I don't think so, no.
You played a man called Tag.
I did. I mean, it was a very strange series. Everybody, in the old days, if you started a job, the director of photography, the production designer, the makeup and hair. No one ever left the job. Now, someone gets a better job and you come in on Monday and say, oh, so-and-so's left, we've got no DP. Everyone, it's turned into a much flakier business. And
completely the gig economy.
Yeah, it's the gig economy. And everyone goes if there's something better further along the line. And we lost our production designer on week one and then they never got another one. And the whole thing... It was a very, very strange experience, but one that I enjoyed a lot, actually.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed watching it, I have to say.
Did you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was looking forward to series two.
Oh, right. Well,
thank you very much for telling
don't
me.
Don't dress for it.
There won't be one. So, Dumbledore.
Mm.
Now, did you seek the role in the TV series?
Again, here's another role that I think that I, you know, there's so many broomsticks currently flying around above our heads without drivers because they've all, you know, dropped off the perch, so to speak. And I thought, God, I must try and get in.
To follow in the footsteps of two Irishmen,
yes.
Richard Harris and Michael Gambon.
Yes.
That would be wonderful.
It would be wonderful. I haven't got the role yet. And I might have jinxed myself out of it by speaking about it too much. But I feel, you know, my generation of actor, trained as I was in projection on the stage, we're the last generation, really, that have a tie to the actor managers of the late 19th century. Because when we were at drama school, we tore tickets in the National Theatre or dressed actors, and we saw people like John Gielgud, Ralph Richardson, Laurence Olivier, Alec Guinness, and they saw people like Georges Du Maurier and Henry Beerbohm Tree, the first naturalists in show business. And so my tradition comes from all that, and Michael Gambon and Richard Harris too. So I think I'm the last type of person who could play Dumbledore. Plus, according to J.K. Rowling, Dumbledore is G-A-Y. I think the part's written for me.
It's written for you, definitively so. Do you watch yourself back?
Not anymore.
Did you ever watch yourself
back? Yeah, when I had tight, gorgeous, silk-like skin, where I could just flick an eyelid and convey something, yes. But when you get older as an actor, I realize now why all old actors overact. And it's because you have so much flesh that you can't do a little flicker of the eyelid or a little, because no one notices. You've just got two little raisins peeking out of, you know, two huge folds of flesh. It's very difficult. That's why when you look at people like Al Pacino, they're all talking like that. Whereas in the old days, if they had a line like, "Do you want a cup of tea?" they'd say, "Do you want a cup of tea?" Now they, "Do you want a cup of tea?" So it's, you know, it's difficult being older.
Yeah. But there are more prominent roles for older people, I suspect.
No, there's none left. In the old days, there was tons. Now there's not very many.
But the role of Tag in that movie, he was an older, wise and wicked CIA man.
He was. But, for example, in Harry Potter, all the old characters are much younger now because it's starting way earlier.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's not that easy being old anymore.
Now, another book on the way, what is the theme, or is it more of your rejected scripts?
It's not my rejected scripts. It's fourth in line of memoirs. I'm writing about the last 5 years, the pandemic, and the emergence of, you know, the kind of death of Britain.
Post-Brexit.
Post-Brexit.
Mm. You're not afraid of being scandalous?
No.
Will this be scandalous?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it might be depressing, because I feel a lot of depressing things have happened really in the last 5 years, and we're a little bit up shit creek in a way.
Britain is broken?
Yeah, slightly. I mean, everyone's broken, except for Ireland and Australia. You're the only countries with a surplus.
You can't get to Australia as a £10 pom anymore.
No.
Rather more expensive.
But I think that's an amazing thing. And I think one of the things that I love about being in Ireland, for example, when you walk down a country lane and a car comes past, everyone raises a finger at you. There's a communication.
And it's not the middle finger.
It's not the middle finger, no. Well, it might be. I'm quite blind. But people are more communicative here. And in England, I think we've all got kind of stuck in our inverted glitter ball somehow.
Well, Rupert, it's been a great pleasure reading the book, first of all, which is called The American No, published by Abacus.
A wonderful Christmas present it could make for someone.
Absolutely, and available in every good bookshop.
Good.
Rupert Everett, thank you very much for
joining us. Thank you very much indeed.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.